Yeah. Yeah, this is Jason.
Thanks for coming. You are the chosen few, obviously. Just enough.
Going to heaven?
Yeah. Alright, so I'm going to boil down the essence of seen and not seen to 5 words, I think. Can you read that? Mm-hmm.
Entertainment.
Maybe it's 4 words, actually. Instruction, number 2. What's the next one? All right. Yeah, 4 words. She can't see, but she already knows. Okay, and anyone want to guess the last one? That's really a tough question. That might be.
Psyche. Close?
Kind of close.
Entertainment
equals instruction. Instruction equals ideology. Ideology equals identity. So what this means is that what we think of as entertainment is always a form of instruction. It's always instructing us in some way with the narratives. What we think of as just instruction always carries in it an ideology. And ideology is part of how we form our identity. I wouldn't say it's the whole picture, but it's a large part of how we create an identity, or how an identity comes into form, is through ideology, which is basically what we value, what we believe is true, what we believe is good, bad, etc. Seen Not Seen is about movies and how they formed my identity, essentially. I didn't know it at the time. I mean, when I was growing up on these movies, I didn't know it while my identity was forming. It's about how, I mean, I imagine everyone here watches TV shows and movies and listens to pop music. Maybe not Miriam. And we tend to think, A, that it's kind of innocent, or harmless, or that it's not affecting us particularly, and B, most importantly, we tend to think that who we are, or how we think of ourselves, determines the entertainment that we choose. The premise of Seen Not Seen is to turn that around, and to argue that the entertainment that we choose determines who we think we are. Which is not to say who we actually are. But that's the whole of that. Ball of wax. So, that's my introduction. I don't necessarily have anything else to say, although I will if anyone has any questions, or I enjoy conversations, but I don't enjoy lecturing very much. But I'm going to read from the book, seeing as this is a reading. I think that's what I'm supposed to do. And it's a it's a very short chapter. Well, it's quite a short chapter. It's the shortest chapter in the book, which is not entirely the reason I picked it, although it's probably related. I'm just going to... can't think of a nice metaphor, so... do that. this is called Peddlers of Astonishment. Tales to Astonish and Nostalgia for the Present.
Can you speak up a little bit?
I will try. Doesn't come naturally, actually. I've noticed that when I play tennis with Nat, with my wife, in the past, you have to shout to keep score. And I noticed that when I shout, my accent, my public school accent, becomes much stronger, which I don't like. When I can speak softly, I have a non-discriminate accent. But when the louder my voice gets, the more I revert to. Don't know why that would be, but anyway. So, Tales to Astonish and Nostalgia for the Present. There is a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald, which I've been using for years, but which I've never been able to locate the source of. The movies have stolen our dreams. Of all betrayals, this is the worst. Can you hear me? Do you need me to speak louder? You do?
Yeah.
I could.
You can come closer.
You could also come closer. Anyone who needs to hear better could also come closer.
Maybe.
I could hear better. I'll say it again then. The movies have stolen our dreams. Of all betrayals, this is the worst. End quote. It sounds good, but what does it mean? Who betrayed whom, and why and how did it happen? No cell phones, please. Childhood is the period of transition between being culture-free and culture-immersed, to being empty of external images, to filled to saturation point with them. Childhood is also an endless capacity for astonishment, in which everything seems new because everything is new, until it gets old. A personal example. I started collecting Marvel comics at around the age of 6. Anyone else read Marvel comics? You're too young, probably. I mean, generationally. You did?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if you're doing Marvel or not.
Well, so you went dedicated.
I went dedicated just to Marvel.
Around the age of 6. Excuse me. That's around the same time my semi-linear memories begin. I don't remember anything prior to the age of 6, really. Is there a connection? If identity is bestowed on us by culture, then pre-culture, did an I even exist? That's an I, not an I. What kind of world was I living in? What kind was I escaping from? I don't remember, so I can only deduce. My deduction is that when I was growing up, my reality was hostile and unsafe, and there was nowhere I could escape to except fantasy. Comic books and later movies provided an external source of fantasy. They were the raw material I used to build my Fortress of Solitude, that's a DC reference, and furnish it with marvels. Over time, that fortress became a prison. The objects and inhabitants of my inner space became fixed outside of me. I'll read that again because it's quite a strange concept. The objects and inhabitants of my inner space became fixed outside of me. As objectively real characters on page and movie screen, they were immune to the influence of my imagination, yet they were fueled and given substance by it. They became the guardians of my inner galaxy, my prison keepers. I was possessed by the spirits of Winnie the Pooh, Piglet, Spider-Man, The Thing and the Silver Surfer, and later by Elvis Presley, Clint Eastwood, Bud Cort, Woody Allen, David Bowie. My inner guardians protected me, but at a price. Like Rapunzel in her tower, I could never leave the Phantom Zone. That's the second Superman record. I became a hostage to the outer images I'd invited into my inner space. The proof of this wild hypothesis? You are reading it. I'm reading it, actually. 40 years later, I'm still writing about these same characters. Here's looking at you, kid. The comic book writer Alan Moore, he's famous for Watchmen and V for Vendetta, and they made a lot of Hollywood movies out of his stuff, and he's taken his name off all of them because he dislikes Hollywood so much. But he was considered, like, almost single-handedly turned comic books into graphic novels, as in respectable for adult kind of product. Anyway, he said he got flack recently for calling superhero fans emotionally subnormal. So, Chris Claremont, the writer of the Uncanny X-Men in the 80s, said more or less the same thing. Quote, "Rarely will you find among fans, comic or sci-fi, a magnificent physical specimen of humanity. Because if you're that good mentally or physically, you don't need the fantasy. The reality is good enough." Who are these people for whom reality is good enough, I wonder? If they exist, they're definitely not artists. Don't Moore and Claremont make a living at escaping into fantasy? Talk about ingrates. Moore's point was that superheroes were originally written for kids and adolescents, but that now those kids were in their 40s and 50s, like me, and still infatuated with the same formulae of tawdry little empowerment fantasies. "I think it's a rather alarming sign," Moore said, "if we've got audiences of adults going to see the Avengers movie and delighting in concepts and characters meant to entertain the 12-year-old boys of the 1950s. Because the comic books have now become these huge Hollywood movie products. Actually, the Avengers was created in 1962, so he got his dates wrong there. When I watch the spanking new Hollywood versions of the Marvel heroes I grew up on, I experience a mixture of nostalgic excitement, the echo of past astonishments, with queasy distaste. I know that these movies are hugely expensive corporate products tied into all kinds of merchandising, but they're exploiting the dreams of new generations of kids while being almost wholly divorced from the original surge of inspiration that created those characters and stories back in the 1960s. And I know that because many of these movies are filled with military hardware and openly or implicitly backed by the US government and armed forces, they are part of a much larger fantasy, that of propaganda for a crumbling capitalist system. This gives the violence and destruction a very different flavor. The 2013 bloated obscenity Man of Steel was like Triumph of the Will, that's the Nazi propaganda film, for the smartphone generation, except that Triumph of the Will was reputedly a work of art, and Man of Steel was unrecyclable garbage, the toxic waste of a sickening empire. I hope no one here liked Man of Steel, because you're upset. The dream has been stolen, and the dreamer betrayed. This played out in the real world too, when the DC Corporation left Superman's creators, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, out in the cold. The intellectual property of Superman belongs to the corporation, not to the creators. The same thing happened to Jack Kirby at Marvel and a host of other writers and artists. The way a relationship ends shows the potential that was there from the beginning. However long it takes for the rot to sink in, the seeds of corruption must have been present at the start. Just going to do this again. The problem with living in a world of fantasy is that it's lonely. The problem with living in the real world is that it's overpopulated and extremely difficult to get other people to agree with you or to get things to turn out the way you want. Hence the need for fantasy. The best of both worlds is to create your own fantasy reality, like Moore and Claremont, you know, comic writers, and get people to come in and populate it. The catch with this, that's what gurus do by the way, the catch with this is that then you will be obliged to hang out with emotionally subnormal people who desperately need the relief of your fantasy. This is probably why Moore and Claremont are so nonplussed with the state of their former fans. They don't like what the cultural mirror is reflecting back at them. If we need fantasy to survive, which is a question, if we need fantasy to survive, why are we so sure it's bad for us? Isn't turning fantasy into reality the basis for just about everything we do? What's the line between reality and fantasy? How would we know if we found it? The French philosopher Jean Baudrillard, I've never read him, though I tried once, quipped, Disneyland is presented as imaginary in order to make us believe that the rest is real, when in fact America belongs to the same hyperreal order and to the order of simulation. In the same way, movies serve to help people forget that their existence is a movie, a waking dream state that's externally as well as internally generated. How so? Images from the past play endlessly on the interior screens of our minds and keep us voluntarily lost inside the pseudo-narrative of our lives. The goal was to get so swept up in the movie narrative that we'd forget all our troubles, forget ourselves so completely that we'd forget we were even watching a movie or that we'd ever agreed to suspend disbelief and start to believe that this was life. We paid our money and we made our choice. When the French artist, writer, and filmmaker Jean Cocteau asked Serge Diaghilev, whose name I've never had to pronounce in public or anywhere else, an art critic and ballet impresario, what he could do for him in the realm of the theatre, Diaghilev's reply was, "Astonish me." That's art's function, to astonish, to spellbind us. When the fantasy astonishes us so deeply that it trumps reality, we get what we always wanted, relief from a Disneyland reality that isn't, that shouldn't be, good enough for anyone. And when you strip all the fancy adornments and rationalizations away, isn't that what everyone wants? The relief of being utterly and truly astonished by life. Back to the personal, almost to the end. I remember when I was about 8, the cupboard in my playroom where my comic collection was stored, inside cardboard boxes in numerical order. I found images from those comic book covers on the internet recently, The Mighty World of Marvel, Spider-Man Comics Weekly. And while I was looking at them, it felt like it pierced all the way to the core of my being. I'm not even sure if felt is the right word for it. It was more like an invocation, a metaphysical tremor, a wobble in reality, an echo from another time when fantasy images seem more real to me than reality does now. I can remember dimly what it felt like to be that raw, that open, that susceptible to astonishment. Yet those tales that astonished me weren't the real source of my astonishment. In a sense, they were what stole it from me. By causing me to fixate on fantastic images, on marvels outside of my direct experience, they made ordinary life seem, well, ordinary. I associate those images and stories with astonishment now, not because they were so astonishing, but because they captured the endless capacity for astonishment which I possessed then, and fixed it like a butterfly in amber. Now I don't remember the astonishment. I only remember the tale. When I was 8 or 9, I started to write and draw my own comic books, mostly using Marvel characters. Later, I began to write scripts and imagine the movies I would make with my favorite actors. I wrote one for Al Pacino, I remember, about a cop who never loaded his gun until his daughter got kidnapped. They were the not-so-humble beginnings of my artistic aspirations, aspirations that continue to this day. As a reader and moviegoer, I want to be astonished. As a writer, etc., I want to astonish others and get the credit for it. It seems harmless enough, even natural. Who doesn't feel that way sometimes? But now that I'm trying to write about what drives me to write, to get at what's underneath all the fancy rationalizations and intellectualizations and bust open my own fantasy narrative. My writing is starting to dry up and I can barely form sentences the way I want to. My writing is slowly transmogrifying into an apology for writing. How dourly English, or dourly, how dourly English, because we apologize for everything. And yet, ridiculously, if I didn't feel the need to apologize, there'd be nothing to apologize for. So maybe amends is what I'm shooting for. Creating products like this one, out of one's inner life via arrested adolescence, superhero fantasies of the will to power, or whatever, and then using them to impress others, starting with mum or dad, maybe this is where the original betrayal occurs. Is this how and when the exploitation first begins, with the exploitation of oneself? The day I let pop culture infiltrate me and swore allegiance to it, I became a carrier for it, in lifetime service to it. Anything for an identity, anything to be a somebody. What does it benefit a child if he gives up his internal kingdom to gain a mighty world of marbles? I'm talking about pop culture, but it applies to all kinds. It begins with pop culture because that's what grabs us as kids, and I do mean grabs. Culture is a bacterium that lives off an organism and transforms it, like yogurt, for example, is culture-based food. It can be benevolent or malignant, or a bit of both. It can even move between benign and malign, good and bad, depending on the nature of the host organism or the relationship between the two. What it can never be is integral to the system it lives off. Who doesn't want to be astonished? Astonishment is the most precious commodity there is. Without it, nothing amounts to much, but with it, wonder of wonders, even the smallest offering becomes enough. We are drawn to art, both as recipients and creators, as a way to get free of the bogus tales of the past, still playing endlessly out on our interior movie screens, to return to that raw, open feeling of being in the present. Ironically, because that in-the-moment living experience, that innocence, is lost in the distant past, when we try to recapture it, we are trying to bring the past into the present, and we end up getting lost in the past. It's like we are seeking to feel nostalgia for the present. That's how the cultural bug of fantasy gets transmitted, from host to host and sea to shining sea. That's how the whims of the fathers and mothers are passed down to the sons and daughters. When we adopt the mistaken belief that we need extraordinary things to feel astonishment, we lose our capacity to be astonished by ordinary things. We seek to make our lives extraordinary, to become artists, visionaries, superstars. We look for ever more tales to astonish. The especially gifted become peddlers of astonishment. There ends the chapter. So, I don't have much to add, but I had a thought while I was in the pool today, and it kept coming back to when I was reading that. So I'll see if I can remember it. When we watch a movie or read, I didn't realize you had Superman there the whole time.
Yeah.
A spy.
I was going to say, we read them when he was little, but he and his dad are starting to read them now.
Right.
His dad was into them. Yeah, well, I don't know if he was into them even as a kid.
Yeah.
I don't think it happened until he was older.
Well, that's unusual.
His interest in them, but...
So is Superman your favorite superhero?
No. This is technically for my dad.
Yeah, we did
that's
pick
a
it
reversal.
Up for him. He couldn't make it to me.
That's a terrible reversal. Yeah, I like the darker. Superman was always too good for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like Wolverine. Anyway, I'll try and remember that thought. When we watch movies or comic books or music, when we want to kind of get immersed in this world, this whatever you would call that, that world, this imaginary world. A big part of it is relief from our identity. We get to forget all our problems. Right? We get to forget ourselves, forget who we are. It's a really good movie for me, particularly movies, really good. The narrative of the movie takes over our internal narrative that's constantly worrying and fretting and trying to figure out how to improve our lives. And we're just, we're in this manufactured narrative where we have no control, we don't need to control because it's fantasy. And that's great. I mean, that feels really good. It's really enjoyable. That's entertainment. And I would even say that is a positive thing that we can, that really can help. It's like meditation. Like people spend decades meditating, trying to just forget themselves for a second. Me, I just look for a good movie and I'm there. I'm too lazy for the meditative route. But the flip side of that is that, and the danger here is that while these stories help us to forget our identity, they do so by giving us a surrogate identity. And so it's kind of like conditioning. If we suspend disbelief in the narrative so much that we no longer discern the effect it's having on us, let's say, then what these entertainment narratives that are instructing us, but telling us stories or giving us models of reality, they instill us, or they implant in us ideologies. And out of those ideologies, those ideologies give us a firmer sense of identity. So we might actually feel better after a movie. We feel more like powerful or more courageous or more decisive, or yes, I'm going to turn my life around. It's a really good movie. It inspires them. But the catch to that is that it's a false. It's a false identity. It's not. It's come from outside. It's come from fantasy. And behind that fantasy are all these agendas. We're talking about corporate products and movies, particularly, but all of that, really. That are embedded with these agendas, these ideological agendas, which have nothing to do with growth, spiritual growth or psychological growth. They're antithetical to it. So that's what I was thinking in the pool. Yeah, it's good to escape into fantasy, but it's not so good to bring back any of those elements that we got to enjoy in the fantasy back into our lies, or to let them actually colonize our inner space. And that, I mean, I'm still working on that, like how to just really enjoy movies and TV shows and not feel somehow infiltrated by them. So that's what Seen and Not Seen is. It's a handbook for how to watch movies without getting your hands dirty.
Is that even possible?
Is it even possible? Yeah, that's probably more what it is. It's an exploration of whether that is possible. I think it's possible if you write books about it. Like, this writing this book was a way for me to sort the seeds of that and actually start, in a way, removing those influences or recognizing those influences as external and false. And kind of, like I said, it's kind of a confession, really. Like, well, yeah, it is very much a confession to myself, because I'm the only one who cares about my sins. Don't have a padre. I used to have a guru. I'm all right now. So that's probably all I have to say. I think there's time if anyone wants to question me, interrogate, or challenge, or heckle. Or
could you put anything else up there besides entertainment as far as that whole process goes?
Another word, you mean?
Like other things that we encounter.
That then go to the other ones. Well, I would say narratives, really.
Like, so,
Hmm?
Like relations and people?
Education?
Well, education obviously is right
it's
here.
Instruction,
and
yeah.
Of course now with, you know, well, for example, the news, we've got the age of infotainment, so basically to get people to pay attention to the news, it has to be packaged as entertainment. So I'd say maybe something similar with education, that they're trying to dumb it down, dumb down education, which of course means dumbing down those that are educated. As far as relationships, that's a bit different, isn't it? I mean, people bring their own ideologies and whatnot into a relationship, but I think as far as supplanting something here, we're looking at something that seems kind of innocuous and innocent and devoid of an agenda, but isn't. So I'd say specifically that.
And that's a huge part of our culture. Mm-hmm.
Entertainment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, like they pay actors more than they pay teachers or librarians. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's true. It's part of the values of our culture.
And sports stars.
I was going to say sport.
That's entertainment too, right?
It is entertaining, yeah. I was thinking of sport. Because I was never into sport, I couldn't say much about it. It always seemed kind of devoid of real interest because it's not obviously a narrative. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it is the basic narrative of good guys versus bad guys. So you've got your team, mm-hmm. you've got to really be behind your team and you hate the other team. And in England, you've all heard about it, I'm sure, football hooligans. People get beaten senselessly over which team, you know, supporting the wrong team. So, it's all kind of surrogates for war, but that's probably oversimplifying, but it's does seem to be part and parcel of this. But like the war industry, which keeps the machines of capitalism turning, you can see that influence or that element in entertainment. Like sport is surrogate war, the simulated war. Movies are so often violent and to do with good versus evil. So it does seem to be that entertainment is connected to the primal drive to, survival, I suppose, like a survival-based thing. It becomes distorted. But that was not answering your question.
So it works in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Like, because, I mean, and this is what Seen Not Seen's about to a large extent, like, I was not violent as a teenager at all. I was the opposite of violence. I was, you know, very meek and mild and physically, I still am, you know, I was the kind of person who was more likely to get beaten up. Unfortunately, I didn't, but certainly did everything I could to avoid any kind of violent interaction. I did wear Dr. Martin boots up to here and Nazi greatcoat, but that was all part of the same thing, that I was attracted to violent stories and violent characters. Clint Eastwood was the main one. To create a surrogate identity where I would feel strong and powerful, because I wasn't a violent person, but I was living in a violent society. So Clint Eastwood seemed like, wow, well, he's mean and he's tough, but he's tall, he's good looking, he's charming, he's charismatic, he seems like a good guy. In real life, a policeman like Dirty Harry would be a real scumbag. I mean, it's just not somebody that you would want your kids to emulate. Right? So that's Hollywood, the power of Hollywood. And also superheroes like, I recommend Watchmen to your dad because it's a brilliant deconstruction of the superhero thing, because it approaches the superhero idea of what if it was real, what if there really were people who put on costumes and went around beating people up. They would be disturbed. They would be very neurotic people, right?
You get old.
There are people that do that though now, right? Uh-huh. In Seattle, and that it's like a thing.
a new thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're vigilantes. Yeah. Where?
Yeah.
Vigilantes in
Chihuahua. 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bring justice?
Yeah, it would bring justice.
Okay.
Yeah, like street patrols and stuff. Yeah.
They call them librarians.
What did you say?
He said they call them librarians.
There seems to be two different paths you can go on, though, in the entertainment, from what I'm gathering. It's, you can watch it and see this violent person and escape your own reality and try and have them be your surrogate identity, as you just said.
Right.
Or there seems to be this path, too, where entertainment influences you and you see the violent person and you see that as something to aspire for and you become that violent person yourself.
Weren't they the same thing?
Well, one, you seem to escape your own personality. You're not it yourself, because you said you stayed meek and you weren't violent yourself, but you found your identity in this violent person.
Yeah.
And the other route,
as opposed to actually becoming a cop, say, and buying a gun.
Yeah, and which seems to be this route here. I mean, if I was watching entertainment.
No, I would say it's a spectrum, because I mean, I did buy a gun. I bought a replica, a 44 Magnum. It wasn't real, but I got the gun. I'd style my hair like Clint Eastwood. I put on the school thing, what do you want to be when you grow up? A cop. I did actually, if I could have become Dirty Harry, I would have done.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, there was no way. It wasn't going to happen. So it's not as though it's one or the other.
Yeah.
It's where you, and you know, if you read, or you are reading the book, you'll see that I did engage in behaviors that were destructive, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It did translate to filter down into action, even if it was against myself. I didn't go around, you know, beating up junkies and black people like my hero would have me do, but still, you know, it's still on the same spectrum. It still did translate into behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say even that allowing external values to create, or allowing them to create an identity in oneself, or using them, is a kind of violence against oneself, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I find, well, for myself, I have problem watching violent movies. I can hardly do it.
Mm.
And sometimes I watch ones that have an intriguing story or idea behind it. And so I get what you're saying, and I totally agree, because I come at it from a different angle, where I grew up, you know, watching, I don't know, the teen romance novels, or the geeky girl, me, becoming this popular person who everybody loves. And so at first I listened to your story, I was like, oh, I don't know if I can relate. And then, well, yeah, I guess I can, because I still feel like I'm that, you know, I don't know, little geeky high school girl who wants everybody to like her, and all of a sudden turns some magical corner.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a big part of it, is, and that's the Fitzgerald quote, is being instilled with dreams that are not our own.
Mm.
Wanting to actually be or become someone that we were never meant to be.
Or is it that sometimes we wish that, and then we see that, and we go, uh-huh, see, I told ya. That can happen,
right.
So that's what I should...
Yeah, well,
like Cinderella.
Or who knows where it starts, might be chicken and the
that
egg.
It is, I mean, they seem to happen together, but, so that gets into the question of like, the people who create fantasy narratives and are successful, I would say, are the ones who,
tap into what's there.
They're tapping into their own trauma, their own lack of identity, their own feeling of being unsafe, just being themselves, creating these fantasies that satisfy some need in them, and then that's what people respond to. So yes, it is real. There's a real, and there's archetypes, you know, the Jungian thing of archetypes. There are, like Superman is an archetypal character. Like a couple of thousand years ago, this is Zeus or Apollo, you know, he was one of the gods. And it's just an updating of that. Mm-hmm. So they kind of predate, almost predate culture. They're so deep in the psyche. Mm-hmm. They're like principles of existence or something. Like you've got gravity and electricity. Those are part of nature. For the Egyptians, the gods were like, that's all they were forces of nature. So there is something really basic about these, the archetypes that get turned into fantasy narratives that goes to the very deepest part of us. That is, I think you're saying, it's not, it's just, there really is something real in our psyche which resonates with that and says, yes, I am that. It's just that we're getting the counterfeit. Mm-hmm. It's an imitation. Even the gods, I would say, are counterfeits. I mean, as in the myths that tell stories of gods, they're written by humans. So it's not, they're no substitute for direct experience of reality, the thing that everyone's trying to avoid. Yeah. Any other questions? Or comments? Or jokes?
Very nice, very interesting.
Could you hear me all right?
Well, when the voice drops, it's just me. At my age, I think my hearing is not the way it once was. That's all. It's not you, it's me.
Well, yeah, I'm a mumbler. Like, for me to even speak at this level is quite, is unusual. Uncomfortable even.
Yeah.
I'd rather be doing like this.
Yes.
I was thinking when you were talking about entertainment and narrative and getting lost in a mood, it's very much like reading fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
For me, it's very hard to read nonfiction because I'd much rather. Yeah. It's way easier for me to just have fiction.
It's very, very interesting about that, the reading books, because I think in a certain sense it's the most complete immersion, because I think the identity is basically mostly a language-based construction. Like it's our internal dialogue that's just telling us all day long who we are, reminding us, I'm this, I like this, I don't like that, I want this, I don't want that. All day long, that, and that's words, that's language. So if we read a book and it captures us, the writer's narrative transplants our internal dialogue. Instead of hearing our own voice, we're hearing the writer's thoughts. Of course, we're still thinking, so the two get spliced together, which is very intimate. If you think about it, it's like our brains are getting melded together with the writer's brain. And I agree, there's nothing quite as transporting as a really good book. So I recommend. Yeah.
So you would say the different types of entertainment where it might start out have an influence on how it ends up in the end by what kind of entertainment we get, whether it be movies or books or...
How it ends up? In what sense?
Like you were just talking about the books and how that's probably a more cohesive one or more implanting.
More intimate. Yeah.
More intimate, so... It seems like the different mediums or whatever that it starts out with has some kind of way of influencing the end result of identity, almost.
The medium is the message.
That's what I was getting to, but I didn't want to say it.
I was thinking recently about poetry, too, and how poets in the past have been so highly valued, and then what you say about language and identity. It's possible that poets, actually, real poets, are kind of technologists. Mm. They're kind of technologists because they know language or how to manipulate language in such a way to adjust
the program. It's like programming, you know, because that's how we do programming, is by writing it.
Yeah. So we don't really have poets anymore. Not like we used to.
Well, we have entertainers, mostly. And poetry in certain cultures, like in Ireland, for example, the bards, the poets, and they, in the old Irish culture, they were considered It wasn't a status thing exactly, but they were the most respected, and they, it was a political kind of office, but not in the sense that they were propagandists, but that they were the voice of wisdom that shaped the cultural norms and values and whatnot. I was just thinking in terms of the medium and the message and all that, that I read a few times that comic books may be the closest to representing consciousness in some way because, well, A, they're a mixture of images and words, and B, that the DNA, and so I'm not going to be able to put this in there, I don't have the text for that, but the way that comics is a strip of images has something to do with the way that DNA works, and that so comic books, so, because I think it has to do also with left and right brain. When you're reading a comic book, you are engaging both sides of the brain simultaneously, right? Because the left brain is language, and the right brain is visual. So generally, if you watch a movie, you're more in the right brain, and if you read a book, you're more in the left brain. But in your comic book, you're constantly moving back and forth, because you can't read the what Superman's saying and look at what he's doing at the same time, right? You actually have to. But actually there are some autists, which is also what the book is about, who can read, so they could probably do this with comic books, what I just said you can't do, they can read both sides of the page at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right?
That was Kim Peek.
So not necessarily autistic, but yeah. Some savants. You know.
Yeah, he was a prodigious savant.
Yeah. So yeah, the way that this is another thing also, the way that the brain or the whole, I'd say the total body, processes information from the outside is very varied. Like we think of it as just this one basic way, and that's, but it's actually not. We're capable of processing information in very many different ways and much more holistically. And so this is part of how the medium is the message, is that when we watch movies and read books and whatnot, it's not just the narratives that are embedding in us, but they're also training us to perceive in a certain way. So we then get locked into this way of perceiving things in a linear fashion in terms of narratives.
And just with our eyes and our ears, right?
Focusing on the eye, on those senses, and not so. There's something to say about the internet, the age of internet, which is interesting in that it's more tactile. Mm. You think of it as visual, but actually, a huge amount is actually in the hands and with the mouse and manipulating. So it's more of a tactile thing, which is closer to something. You know. The narrative, the predominance of narrative has taken us, I think, further and further away from just being physically present, which is the appeal of them in some sense. Like if you're ever really ill, one thing you want to do is just kick back and watch movies. Or tennis if you're not.
Hours.
I used to read comic books when I was ill. Yeah.